Hello, and welcome to the Women's Hour. I'm Kelly Pyle, your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster. Today's show features articles from the November 3rd and November 10th editions of People, as well as the Fall 2025 edition of Women's Health. Some of the articles that I will share today include Michelle Obama at Her Best, What Top Heart Docs Do to Stay Healthy, and The Race to Vegas. Michelle Obama at Her Best. Nearly a decade after leaving the White House, the former First Lady is more confident about who I am. She looks back and gets candid about her life now. By Janine Rubenstein. Photographs by Eric Carter. This is a People exclusive. It's like a scene from one of her past Let's Move campaign events. Michelle Obama is working it outside Washington, D.C., fingers snapping, hips swaying, a couple of carefree twirls. Only on this afternoon, the former First Lady isn't surrounded by a cohort of cute kids, fans, news cameras, and critics. No, that ship has long sailed, and she's at peace not being on it. Instead, at her People photo shoot, she's draped in a colorful Jason Wu top and moving entirely to the beat of her own drum and the uncensored sounds of Glorilla, Beyonce, and Cardi B pumping through the speakers. Fundamentally, I'm the same person, says Mrs. Obama, who these days prefers just Michelle. But with each decade, I've grown wiser. I think I've become more confident about who I am. This version of Michelle probably cares less about what other people think. Her journey in the global public eye is at the center of her new coffee table book, The Look, out November 4th. Co-written with her longtime stylist, Meredith Koop, it chronicles how the wife of the first Black president of the United States meticulously dressed for the job, and all the celebration and relentless scrutiny that came with that. I purposefully did not talk about fashion and beauty during the 8 years in the White House, she says. I was afraid it was going to take over everything. But now at 61, nearly a decade into life after husband Barack Obama, 64, left office, and more than a few years into being an empty nester, since daughters Malia, 27, and Sasha, 24, flew the coop, she says, it was time to talk about that journey. Below, Michelle 2.0, a hip podcaster and avid tennis player who's often rocking a crisp set of braids, effuses about her style, impact, and happy home life. This is the first time, she says, where every decision that I make is for me. Let's start with little Michelle Robinson from the South Side of Chicago. Where did she get her first sense of beauty and style? Soul Train. That was Saturday morning viewing in the Robinson household. As a little girl, I would just marvel, not only at the moves and being able to see your favorite artists, but at the way the women dressed. Just the color, the style, the flair. I thought, that's what cool is. You write about your early journey to self-confidence. How did you learn to drown out the noise and love yourself? Look, being a tall girl, I'm 5'11", and my father, Fraser Robinson, was very clear about standing straight and owning my height. It was like, you do not slouch. You are tall, you are beautiful. I think it started there. I'm still working on every day, waking up looking in the mirror and telling myself that I am smart and beautiful and kind and worthy. I don't think that work ever stops for women, particularly women of color, because sometimes you don't always hear it back. Women today, we're facing a time now where people with power are trying to quiet the voices of people they disagree with. And I think now more than ever, it's a time when we have to fight to remind ourselves that we matter, that we count. You met Barack when you were a high-powered attorney. What was your go-to look back then? I am certain that it was some kind of 80s power suit. You had to show up at your corporate law firm in a uniform, a very, very shouldered suit, some kind of feminine-ish blouse, pantyhose, which I hated. Now that I mention it, I don't know what he saw, she laughs. I'm like, that doesn't sound very sexy. It was the 80s. When you entered the White House, there was still that sense of needing a uniform, but with more pressure. How did you handle that? I just understood the assignment. It was a complicated assignment. The role of First Lady is kind of job, non-job. You know that you're supposed to be inspirational, yet accessible. You should be uniquely yourself, authentic, but representational at the same time. And as a Black woman, I felt that I had to make sure that people could see my feminine side. Especially early on in the campaign, when I was being attacked as being angry, a shrew, demeaning my husband. All these labels were coming in on me that were essentially trying to rob me of that femininity. I understood that going into it. And I didn't feel like it was a struggle to do it because, number one, I respected the position. I took the role as First Lady very seriously. I was a famous person, but I wasn't a starlet. And so that meant that the clothes could never speak louder than anything I had to say. Even still, your style choices had a major impact. Stuff would sell out in minutes. How did that feel? I didn't pay attention to it. I didn't want to go down that rabbit hole of listening to other people's comments about my physical self, whether good or bad. But I liked the fact that in hindsight, people identified with what I was wearing. Because if I wore something and it could sell out, that meant that most women could afford to buy it. And I thought that's a good thing. I wanted the people of America, all people of all races, of all political persuasions, to be able to connect with me. What about times when criticism, like that of your bare arms, got through to you? I took it for what it was, pure hypocrisy. I could pull up pictures of Jackie O in a second and see this fashion icon in sleeveless dresses as First Lady. So at a point you're like, oh, this is politics. If you can't beat them, make everybody scared of them. That was the motto. If it wasn't the clothes, it was the terrorist fist bump. It was every word that we said. It was my husband's tan suit. Take us back to 2014, when that tan suit was deemed unpresidential. I loved that tan suit. When he had it on, I was like, oh my God, you look so cute. Then I was like, oh, you got clocked for that one. Welcome to my world. That was toward the end of his presidency, so we were used to all the crazy issues that people would take with us. There were good times, too. You write about how you used to treat state dinners like date night. For those black tie events, that was like our wedding every time. You felt like the belle of the ball. With each year, I got a little riskier. My team and I tried different things. And you're getting all doled up for your man. There was an unspoken ritual. He never knew until I walked out ready what I was wearing. That's the romance. Those little moments in this crazy world where we could look at each other and go, "You're cute." Then we walked downstairs to a barrage of press, lights, and cameras. And it's like, just stay in this moment. It's really just us. This is nice. What does date night look like now? We've been married 32, 33 years. I always forget. Sorry, honey. When we're both happy about date night, we're at home. We are not getting dressed. We just have a nice dinner, candles lit, music. We talk. We don't talk for the whole day because we're in the house together all day, right? We work from home. So when we are going to have a really special night, it's like, don't talk to me, save it for dinner. He'll be like, did you talk to the girls? I did, but we're not going to talk about it until date night. But sometimes we go out for dinners in DC or wherever. I am too old. I can't do dinner in a movie. I will fall asleep in the movie. So it's like, let's pick one. You mention your daughters. Back in the White House, how did you shape their image while giving them autonomy? So we had a deal. You work with my stylist, Meredith Koop, when dressing for public events. What's in for a 13-year-old is not acceptable walking down the staircase of Air Force One. It was like, when you're with us, you're like me. You're on a job. And so your choices can't lead, but you can be part of the process. Meredith worked with them, and she had those fashion fights. But in their own world, it was all them. Barack would be like, those shorts seem really short. And I was like, don't say anything. Let them cook. Similarly, you're exploring your own style more these days and you're loving braids. It's freedom. Braids allow me to get them done, and that's one less thing that I have to think about. When I'm out of the public eye, I am swimming, I am playing tennis, and braids represent that kind of freedom for me. In the White House, I wasn't sure whether the country was ready for it. The Crown Act, which protects employees and students from race-based hair discrimination, hadn't passed yet, and I just felt like fashion. I didn't want my hair to become a distraction. But I understood the significance of wearing braids to our portrait unveiling. I wanted to send a message, add to the discourse of Black women in places of power saying, this too is an appropriate and beautiful way to wear your hair. Lastly, how's life in your 60s, inside and out? I'm not wincing at my gray hairs, but I am coloring them. My mother, Marianne Robinson, was the same way. She dyed her hair until the day she died. I don't really do much else. Fortunately, black don't crack. But my health has always been paramount. What I eat, working out, regular doctor's visits, all the things that allow me to enjoy this time. I'm as vibrant as I've ever been. My kids are grown and launched. They are healthy and happy. My husband is doing just fine. We are the former president and first lady. And so I feel like this is the first time in my life that when I say and do something here in this interview, writing this book, these are my choices. That is freeing. This has been a People Magazine exclusive. Michelle Obama at her best. What top heart docs do to stay healthy. Taking care of your heart seems so straightforward. Exercise, eat whole foods, de-stress, sleep more, until it doesn't. our favorite cardiologists are up against the same stuff. Dinners out, late nights, MIA motivation, as the rest of us. Here, their tricks for prioritizing their health and taking down the number one killer of women. Yes, that is heart disease. By Olivia Lupino. Number one, the challenge, scoring enough sleep. The hack, negotiate the details. Running on just 5 hours of sleep used to be a point of pride for Sharon N. Hayes, MD, a cardiologist and professor of cardiovascular medicine at Mayo Clinic, until she kept noticing all the research about how important adequate sleep is for heart health. If you're wondering, good sleep is associated with lower death rates from cardiovascular diseases, and in fact from all causes, according to a recent review in the American Journal of Preventive Cardiology. That's because it has benefits for your blood pressure, blood sugar, and weight control, Dr. Hayes says. When she got the wake-up call that she wasn't getting enough, 7 to 9 hours is ideal, she knew she couldn't make a sleep commitment alone. If you have a sleeping partner, in my case, my spouse, there probably needs to be some cooperation, or at least not obstruction, to a behavioral change like this, she says. She and her husband hit the sheets at the same time every night. Research found that people with irregular sleep patterns were more likely to have plaque in their coronary arteries. And agree that if one of them isn't sleepy, the other will read a book on their phone in the dark. Off went the TV and in came more sleep. We realized that late night TV was more of a habit, and we honestly don't miss that habit that much, she says. To stay up on those shows, the New York Times Best of Late Night newsletter and must-sees on demand do the trick. Number two, the challenge, being consistent with exercise. The hack, find an enthusiastic partner. Exercise is so good for your heart that an entire category of movement is named after it. Yep, you want to get your cardio in, whether it's with a brisk walk, run, bike ride, swim, or something else. Spending 75 to 150 minutes per week elevating your heart rate can lower your risk of dying from cardiovascular disease by up to 31%. One way to keep workouts consistent, buddies you can't say no to. Martha Gulati, MD, who specializes in women's hearts at the Smith Heart Institute at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center, has always been a runner. In the past few years, she subtracted some miles and added some joy in the form of Binkley 12, her Springer Spaniel Aussie Shepherd mix, and Cocabella 5, her Portuguese water dog. Dr. Gulati puts them both on a hands-free leash and they peel out. It's their happy time and mine, she says. Since Binkley is getting older, she's trimmed her runs down to 2 miles. If you're looking for a new running buddy, breeds like Weimaraner, Dalmatians, Vizslas, Rhodesian Ridgebacks, and German Short-Haired Pointers are known for their athleticism, according to the American Kennel Club, and for what it's worth, if your dog isn't into running, they may be helping your heart anyway. Owning one is associated with reduced blood pressure. The challenge, eating well when eating out. The hack, order 3 dishes instead of 1. Dining out, get creative. I hardly ever order from the main entree menu, says Amparo C. Villablanca, MD, director of the Women's Cardiovascular Medicine Program at the University of California, Davis Health. There's too much of too few ingredients, and the portions are almost always too large. So she orders two or three apps or side dishes. Opt for ones that are plant-based and rich in heart-healthy oils like olive oil. Go light on sweets, processed foods, and red meat. Number four, the challenge, staying positive. The hack, journal for 5 minutes. Being optimistic is associated with a 35% lower risk of cardiovascular events, according to a review in Psychosomatic Medicine. But how do you get there in a world where there's, frankly, a whole lot to be worried about? Every morning and every night, Stacy Ellen Rosen, MD, Executive Director of the CATS Institute for Women's Health at Northwell Health, opens up her 5-minute journal and follows its prompts, which includes what would make your day great, as well as the day's highlights and lessons learned. She says this helps her brain spend less time thinking negative thoughts, which helps her focus on the good in her life and feel more optimistic. Whether it's due to mindfulness, the offloading of stress, the importance of gratitude, or the enhanced focus, Dr. Rosen believes that using the book has brought her additional heart bonuses, such as improvements in physical activity, sleep, and diet. Number five, the challenge, finding time for working out. The hack, sneak in activity anytime, anywhere. With kids ages 4 and 1, plus a busy medical practice, Emily S. Lau, MD, MPH, Director of the Women's Heart Health Program at Brigham and Women's Hospital, doesn't have the luxury of a consistent chunk of time for a regular exercise routine. So she relies on exercise snacks. This approach, finding short opportunities for movement throughout the day, like taking the stairs, walking when you have a break, or parking your car farther from your destination, actually does make a difference. A recent study in sports medicine and health science found that these snacks can improve cardiorespiratory fitness, a factor important for heart health and longevity. When she can be more structured about exercise, she'll switch off childcare with her husband. Everybody's work and family life is a little bit different, she says, but I think the principles are just being able to try to use creative ways to incorporate it into one's life. Number six, the challenge, keeping active even with injuries. The hack, get ahead of flare-ups. C. Noel Barry Mertz, MD, Director of the Barbara Streisand Women's Heart Center at Cedars-Sinai, was an athlete growing up, but an injury nearly 40 years ago left her part of a group nobody wants to be in, the back pain crew, which up to 85% of Americans will join at some point in their lives. Back pain gets in the way of the exercise, the sleep, and the social life you need to protect your heart. She lived that way for about 10 years until she learned some physical therapy stretches, including the classic cat-cow. She spends 12 minutes a day doing them for the last 30 years and hasn't had a flare-up since. You don't have to suffer pain and watch your heart health suffer too, she says. You see patients who get really stuck with an injury. Learn what you need to do to get through it, and then take a few minutes a day to stay ahead of re-injury. You have been listening to What Top Heart Docs Do to Stay Healthy from Women's Health Magazine. The race to Vegas. The Formula One Grand Prix roars into town November 20th through 22nd. By Sunol Dutt, with additional reporting by Julie Mazziota. This is from People Magazine. Las Vegas transforms into a high-octane playground when Formula One takes over the strip, bringing along an adrenaline-filled lineup of concerts, parties, and motorsport theme activities. Whether you're a race fan or simply along for the ride, planning ahead, like securing a clear viewing spot for the big Saturday night race, or confirming a dinner reservation at a buzzy new restaurant, will make the weekend easier to navigate. Use this guide to get your itinerary started. And since many events last until sunrise, you don't have to worry about overbooking or missing out on the fun. You can sleep when you get home. The race runs past landmarks like the Sphere and the Bellagio Fountain. Cote Las Vegas, with a sleek, sexy space and a menu of decadent offerings like steak, omakase, and kimchi wagyu paella, the new Korean barbecue steakhouse inside the Venetian is the hottest table in town. F1 Arcade. The Forum Shops at Caesar's Palace will house 87 full-motion simulators that let you see and feel what it's like to drive the world's top tracks. Pitbull. Mr. Worldwide will keep the good vibes pumping after dark during his two nights of shows at the Fontainebleau on November 21st and 22nd. Shoey Bar. Based on an Australian tradition where partiers drink out of an actual shoe, cocktails at this Bellagio hotspot are served in racing shoes and an inverted helmet. Hello Kitty and Lego. The Sanrio-themed grandstand offers prime and very cute seating for the race. While Lego will have play zones plus a life-size brick-built F1 car. Drivers to watch. Oscar Piastri. In his third year on the F1 circuit, the 24-year-old Australian is a favorite to win the 2025 championship. Max Verstappen. As the reigning four-time F1 champ, the Dutch Red Bull racer is known for his bold precision. Lando Norris, the McLaren driver from England, has been fighting Piastri for the top spot all season. You have been listening to The Race to Vegas. The Formula One Grand Prix roars into town November 20th through 22nd. From People. You are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer broadcaster, Kelly Pyle, and this is the Women's Hour. Some like it hot, and even hotter, an infrared lighty. It's true, everybody's sitting in on this heat trend now. But can sauna sessions really deliver all the mind, mood, and muscle benefits enthusiasts are looking for? By Anna Medeiros from Women's Health magazine. When Kayla Sibilia was 28 years old, she had that unmistakable feeling that she was ready for a big reset. So in the summer of 2016, she packed her bags and moved from San Francisco to a Massachusetts cottage and gave up drugs, alcohol, and sex along the way. She didn't have Wi-Fi or TV. All that was left for a dopamine hit, a dip in the cold saltwater cove, followed by a sit in her heated car. The twice daily rotation was the only thing that really helped me with those urges, Sibilia says. Fast forward to today, and Sibylla has traded her car, Sauna, for a handcrafted wooden sauna on wheels. She began renting it out to her beachside community in Little Compton, Rhode Island, and accidentally discovered her life's work. What started as a way to warm up is now Altair Sauna, her full-time, environmentally friendly mobile sauna business. Locals can't get enough. And just in time, from backyard burn huts to bedside blankets and $50 per session urban sauna clubs, heat therapy is having a literal hot girl moment. Saunas reportedly improve sleep, blood pressure, brain power, and even longevity. Bookings for sauna sits were in the top 5 of ClassPass's wellness reservations last year, and one research firm predicts the global sauna market will top $209 billion in the next 5 years. Everybody's finding a way in. As Gen Zs and millennials sit, sweat, and flirt in cedar-scented rooms while sipping lemongrass teas at city-based social wellness clubs like Othership, Remedy Place, and Bathhouse, saunas are popping up in homes and gyms outside of town too. When Caroline and Brandon Gador got their 2-person Costco sauna installed in Denver this spring, they knew they were firmly part of the trend when their electrician commented, "Last year it was all solar panels. This year it's all saunas." But is this inextinguishable desire for sitting and sweating really doing anything other than costing money and electrolytes? And will the trend burn off, or is it truly a way of life that's here to stay, as so many sauna goers see it? Catching fire. Communal sweating has been around pretty much since the beginning of fire. While the Nordic countries are known for it, Finland famously has nearly as many saunas as people. It has a rich tradition in other cultures too. Native Americans have sweat lodges, Middle Easterners have hammams, and Russians have bathhouses. America is just at the start of the surging interest in sauna culture, says bathhouse co-founder Travis Talmage. This is a 5,000-year-old tradition, and the United States was late to the party. Some industry experts credit the pandemic for this wake-up. It got more Americans invested in immune system-boosting practices and wellness and prompted renovation projects like basement gyms and sunroom saunas. At the same time, loneliness became a certified epidemic. More and more people are looking for invigorating ways to engage and connect with each other, says Marcus Copeland, ND, a naturopathic medical doctor in Los Angeles who specializes in water-based therapies like mineral baths. And in a digital world, people are looking for real, visceral, physical experiences to share with other people, he says. Add to that Gen Z's preference for matcha over mimosas and our obsession with performance and longevity hacks, guilty, and it's not hard to see why sauna bathing is an easy sell. More great news. There is solid science behind the ritual's benefits. A large, long-term study out of Finland found that the more frequently men hit the sauna, the less likely they were to die from heart-related or other diseases over the 20-year study period. A lot less. Nearly half of the men who sauna bathed only once a week died over the duration. Just 31% of those who went 4 to 7 times a week did. It's likely that women would see a similar benefit, says Rebecca Rodriguez-Regner, DO, a Team USA physician and family and sports medicine doctor based in the San Diego area. Saunas may be particularly helpful for women staring down perimenopause and menopause. These phases raise the risk of prediabetes and type 2 diabetes, and regular sauna use might improve blood sugar, she says. Regular sauna use is also linked to a lower dementia risk, per other research. Not surprising when you consider that what's good for the heart is typically good for the brain. Some of the sauna's perks are shorter term. Research out of Finland and the UK found that people who tacked a 15-minute sauna session onto the end of a 60-minute workout 3 times a week saw blood pressure and cholesterol measurements go down after 8 weeks. This kind of post-workout warm down improves blood flow to the muscles, Dr. Rodriguez-Regner adds. So overall, can it make your body feel better, looser, less sore? Yes. Women with conditions like rheumatoid arthritis or back pain often find relief with saunas for many of the same reasons. The inner workings of heat. In an ever hotter world, heat as a health benefit doesn't make sense at first. Heat exhaustion and heat stroke are real things. We're told to stay cool on sweltering summer days when the temperature doesn't even hit triple digits. Where does sauna, sometimes nearing 212 degrees Fahrenheit, get off? The idea, the pros say, is that sitting in a controlled, heated environment for 20 to 30 minutes is a lot like exercising. A reasonable program presents healthy stress, forcing adaptation. Your heart and blood vessels sharpen their ability to circulate oxygen-rich blood to the tissues that need it most. Your skin gets better at controlling body temperature through sweat. Your cells learn to switch on genes that fight inflammation. Your breathing learns to steady in uncomfortable situations. Your confidence grows. Taken together, Copeland says, you're exercising these systems that enhance the body's ability to function at a higher level. That is at least the prevailing theory. The problem for realists is that research on how heat exposure affects the body is conducted in animals or with small human samples. The long-term studies, like that Finnish one, often focus on men. And it's really hard, if not impossible, to design the type of rigorous experiment that proves that sauna use leads to a longer life. Sure, you can try to control for factors like underlying health conditions and socioeconomic status, but really anything else could be the true and overlooked elixir. Commercially, that world has proliferated faster than what the research community has dived into, says Michael Stack, CSCS, an exercise physiologist in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and president of the Physical Activity Alliance, a coalition aiming to make exercise more accessible. When it comes to a performance benefit, most of the studies on anything that involves manipulating temperature, hot or cold, at this point just pretty much end with more research is needed. It's not a cure-all, says Amy Miller, MD, a primary care and sports medicine doctor at the University of Michigan Health. It's not going to make you run leaps and bounds when you couldn't run to begin with. Plus, claims that sauna can detox and cleanse are overblown. People think, I'm going to go in the sauna and get all that stuff out of my system, she says. That's a myth. Sauna diplomacy. Enthusiasts aren't waiting for a medical journal to confirm their experience, though. Sauna bathing feels good. It generally costs money, yet connecting with yourself or others in an iPhone-free zone is worth it, they say. For Caroline Gator, the family's new backyard sauna was mostly her husband's idea. But she found herself drawn to the hut first as a sleep enhancer, and now she stays for the break it gives her from the stimulation of her toddlers and her job as a food scientist. I'm very pleasantly surprised by how enjoyable of a me moment it is, she says. Indeed, one small study found that women who occasionally sat in a 176-degree sauna, a typical temperature, reported decreases in tension, depression, anger, fatigue, and confusion. The communal moments of honesty often take people by surprise, too. Sibylla remembers the first time she was invited to accompany a group of women in her family's Vermont sauna as a teen. All of a sudden, they started having these conversations and using words that I'd never heard before. They were talking to me in a tone that was completely different than the tone that they had used outside of the sauna, she says. She saw them really connecting, not chasing kids or coordinating with husbands and in-laws. That's when I realized, oh, something special is going on in here. As the joke goes, in the sauna, you can't hide anything up your sleeves because you don't have any. You can't get too emotionally heated either, or you won't be able to last. The Finns call it sauna diplomacy, and even use the strategy to make deals with their naked neighbors in their embassy-wide saunas. And if you get too hot, you literally have to stand up for yourself and get out, lest you pass out. What I've learned using sauna is trusting my intuition, Sibylla says. While she and other experts recommend listening to your body rather than following a hard and fast protocol, Copeland's general guidelines are to start with 10 to 15 minute sessions and gradually work up to 30 minutes per session, 3 or 4 times a week. Physiologically, it takes the body about 6 weeks for tissues to change and adapt, Dr. Rodriguez-Regner says. So give yourself that much time to work up to a routine. Your body will become conditioned to the heat and your tolerance will build. That translates to real life. It allows you to adapt to stressors in a more calm fashion, Dr. Miller says. Steam rooms can have similar physical health benefits, plus the added bonus of humidity if you're having skin or respiratory issues, but they do make it harder to have heart-to-hearts. As for temperature, dry saunas typically range from 160 to 212 degrees Fahrenheit, Copeland says. Even at lower temperatures, certain people should avoid saunas or at least talk to their doctor before going in. That includes those who've recently had a heart attack and those who are pregnant. People with neurological disorders, like multiple sclerosis or a brain surgery, as well as those on meds for blood pressure or stimulants for ADHD, might also struggle to thermoregulate, which can raise the risk of heat illness, according to Dr. Miller. Oh, and for everyone, booze and saunas do not mix. Dehydration, dizziness, and heart problems, for starters. With those cautions, even stack the exercise physiologist is on board. If you like it, it feels good for you, you're willing to invest the money, and you feel like there's a benefit, do it, he said, because the downside is none at all. This has been Some Like It Hot from Women's Health Magazine. Patricia Arquette, Embracing My Second Act. The star of Murdaugh, Death in the Family, reflects on her career, legacy, and life as an empty nester. It's Exciting, by Colleen Cradofill, with reporting by Julia Moore. This is from People Magazine. Patricia Arquette has been rethinking what her life looks like these days. It's funny because somebody had told me that Chinese call menopause the second spring, and my life kind of is a second spring, the Oscar winner, 57, says. My kids are grown up, I'm single, I don't have to take anybody else's dreams into account as far as where I want to live or what I want my house to look like. I get to ask myself for the first time, what do I want to do? The answer to that involves indulging in more of what she loves: traveling, crafting, and quality time with friends. This whole world's different, all of a sudden, she says. Arquette split from her boyfriend of nearly 9 years, artist Eric White, in 2023, and raised her son Enzo, 36, whom she shares with musician Paul Rossi, and daughter Harlow, 22, with actor Thomas Jane. Now, she says, she can have all these adventures with people I really miss and want to spend time with. She's also focusing on acting roles that excite her. There's still a lot to explore, she says. Hot off her Emmy-nominated role as the cold and conniving Ms. Cobill on Apple TV's Severance, Arquette portrays wealthy Southern matriarch Maggie Murdaugh in Hulu's new true crime story drama, Murdaugh, Death in the Family, which follows the 2021 murder of Maggie and her 22-year-old son Paul, Johnny Birchtold, at the hands of her husband Alex, Jason Clark. As a true crime fan, Arquette was fascinated by the case. What was really interesting to me was Alex, this charming, charismatic personality who is the head of the family, but also a pathological liar, betrayer, manipulator. And for Maggie to start realizing, I have no clue who I'm married to. To dive into the role, Arquette perfected a Southern twang with the help of a dialect coach. She also reflected on her own experience as it related to Maggie's struggles with Alex's substance abuse. I grew up in a family where there was substance abuse issues with my dad and alcoholism and betrayals, Arquette said of her father, Louis, who died at 65 of congestive heart failure in 2001. If she could have, Arquette says, she would have advised Maggie to be awake and aware and not get normalized to stuff that's not healthy, to talk through her feelings and hold people accountable. And I'm not pointing the finger at her. I'm pointing the finger at myself. I don't feel that I've been great at that. Arquette was raised on a Virginia commune by Louis, an actor, and mother Brenda, a poet, along with her siblings, actors Rosanna, 66, Richmond, 62, Alexis, who died in 2016 at 47, and David, 54. Despite his lack of stability, she credits her charming dad for showing her how hard it is to make a living as an actor, she says. Even today, after scoring Oscar, Golden Globe, and Emmy wins, Arquette says she feels grateful more than proud about how far she's come. "I see a lot of incredibly talented people struggling. I just feel grateful to be working." One person she's helping break into the business is her daughter Harlow, who is filming her first series, Peacock's The 5-Star Weekend with Jennifer Garner. "It's super exciting," she says. "I've seen a lot of her audition tapes. I'll say, before you show me, do you want to show me? Because forget that I'm your mom. You're a fellow actor, so I'm going to tell you the truth." What Arquette sees already impresses her. "I think my dad would be really proud. My grandpa would be proud. My great-grandparents." She's a fifth-generation actor. Arquette is also quick to praise her nieces, Zoe Blue, Rosanna's daughter, 31, who starred in the recent film Dracula, A Love Tale, and Coco, David's daughter with ex Courtney Cox, 21, who is a great actress too. Arquette laughs and adds, "You're not done with us yet." You've been listening to Patricia Arquette, Embracing My Second Act, from People. Thanks, Coach. Top athletes share the best pieces of wisdom they've ever received. Brenna Stewart, WNBA, New York Liberty, co-founder of the 3-on-3 basketball league Unrivaled. Control what you can control. You can't predict hardships or outcomes, but your preparation, your mindset, how you show up for your team, that's always in your hands. Anna Weiss, Pro Sailing, Team Sail GP. My rowing coach in college said, "Just show up. Not every day will be a 100% day. But if you give your maximum effort for where you're at, it's always better than not doing it at all." It's simple advice, but I still think about it this day, especially on those days when training feels like a challenge. Ari McDonald, WNBA, Indiana Fever. Always know your worth, and any person that can't see your worth, it's their loss. Keep staying sharp and trust that what's meant for you is already aligning behind the scenes. That was from my high school coach, Pika Wilborn. Ilana Myers-Taylor, Team USA Bobsled. You don't have to be perfect. You just have to be fast. My coach told me this in response to overthinking and trying too hard to be perfect that I forgot the overall goal: to win the race. Courtney Dahlwalter, Ultra Runner, Team Injinji Athlete. My high school Nordic ski coach taught us that every time we felt like we were at our limit, we could always turn the dial one more notch and find a little more inside of us. We are capable of more than we think. Maddie Westbeld, WNBA, Chicago Sky. My mind coach, Derek Grant, said, "Lions kill 18.2% of the time and are considered king of the jungle." Katie Ledecky, 9-time Olympic gold medal swimmer, Athleta Power of She collective athlete. "Before my first Olympic final at the London 2012 Games when I was 15 years old, my coaches advised me to channel all of the energy and noise from the crowd into my lane. This helped me stay focused on my race rather than being concerned about my competitors. I won a gold medal, so it's advice that I continue to remember when I'm competing today." Stephanie Howe, the North Face Trail Runner. "Play the long game. Fitness and great performances don't happen overnight. They are built over months to years of boring, consistent training blocks. When you give yourself time, not only to layer on training, but also to rest and recover and adapt to the stress, that's where the magic happens. It's very unsexy, but it works. Layla Edwards, hockey, the first Black woman on the U.S. women's hockey team. My youth hockey coach taught me to stick to my game and play with confidence. I truly believe that's the recipe to having fun, and you play your best when you're having fun. Rose Zhang, pro golfer. Coach Walker at Stanford said, "You don't rise to the level of your goals. You fall to the level of your systems." And that's something that I've ingrained in myself. Remember your process, then you'll be able to get to where you need to be. This has been Thanks, Coach. Top athletes share the best pieces of wisdom they've ever received from Women's Health Magazine. Thanks for joining us today for the Women's Hour. My name is Kelly Pyle, and I am your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster. I hope you enjoyed the articles that I read today in our program, and we'll make plans to join us again next week. And don't forget, you can take Sun Sounds with you. You can stream as well as access shows on demand on our Sun Sounds of Arizona app for both Apple and Android. Have a great day, and be sure to stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.